Welcome to Real Talk, real estate discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers to the industry. You can find this show at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Welcome to episode 10 of the Real Talk. We previously had a conversation regarding select service hotels about a month or two ago. In today's episode, we speak with Avi Broche, the founder of Pally Society, where we talk about how Avi has really institutionalized the neighborhood local inn in lodging. He, in Pally Society, he's created a design bespoke driven enterprise, which is counterintuitive to lodging properties where his hotel guests can be inspired. We have a wide ranging conversation where we talk much more than just hotels. We talk about how he handled the GFC and how it set him up for the next 10 years. How we talk about how the homeless, crime, people not working in the office have all impacted the lodging industry. Let's go to my conversation with Avi. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Real Talk. Today, I am here with my good friend and client, Avi Broche, founder of Pally Society. Avi, where does this podcast find you?
Hi, Andrew. How are you? Happy to be here with you today, of course. Today, I'm in my house in Malibu, trying to have a quiet week.
Well, I love it. As we tape here, it's the end of 2022, post-Christmas, before New Year's. I really appreciate you being on the show and taking time out during the holiday season. You know, Avi, I wanted to have you on. Obviously, you and I have talked for many years, and we had this great conversation. I'm going to sort of name drop, not a person, but a place, but at Soho Malibu, not one of your establishments, but an establishment where you like to hang out. And I think I learned more about you in that, I don't know, 45 minutes to 60 minutes of having a cocktail or two than I had in, gosh, 5 or 6 years. And so I really hope that the audience, of which there should be, you know, several hundred million listening and watching on all different mediums, come away after this podcast of learning about you, Avi, learning about Pally, the Pally Hotels, the brand, but what sort of made you to who you are today. And I want to get your thoughts on your view of today's market and what we're seeing in 2023. But first, just give a general overview of Pally Society, Pally Group, and in case our audience isn't aware.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pally Society is it's essentially a branded hotel and hospitality management company. And we design and operate hotels across the country under 5 separate brands. So that's something obviously that didn't happen overnight. It took a long time to get to this place, but in a nutshell, that's essentially what we do. We have about 1,000 employees in the organization and about 25 properties that we're currently actively involved in. And so it's become, you know, it's a fairly substantial enterprise at this point.
So as well known, I would think, in the hotel industry, you know, oftentimes the owner of the hotel brand, like a Marriott or a Sheraton or a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons, doesn't own the hotel. So talk about, of the 25 properties of which you're managing, how many do you have an ownership stake in, and how many are you just purely the hotel manager or the flag?
Yeah, I think the best way to answer that question is give you some perspective as to how we got here, and owning and sponsoring development deals is part of that process. And, you know, as you know, Andrew, I started my career as a real estate developer, and I got into the hotel business, you know, kind of serendipitously. And the way that I did that was essentially I developed my first three properties myself. And when I say develop myself, I was the sponsor or the co-sponsor on some basis. And because nobody gives you a hotel to operate, you know, you have to create your own spaces. You have to create your own bricks and mortar part of it. And we can dig into as deep as you want. But essentially, the first three hotels I sort of made happen on my own using my developer and real estate skill set that I had brought to the table by then. And what's happened subsequent to that is that my desire to grow the brand eclipsed my desire to develop real estate. And what I mean by that is developing real estate, and especially lodging properties, is, you know, it's a cumbersome process, and it takes a long time, and it requires a lot of resources, both financial resources, time resources. And it sort of occurred to me that the way to really dig deeper in terms of being able to grow a branded company was to do it as a, not only for myself, but also being a service provider to others. And so over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, my involvement as being a sponsor or being on the developer side of the deals has gotten smaller and smaller as the brand has evolved. And so I would say of the 25 assets, I'm probably in the capital stack on some basis or sponsoring roughly 20% of the time. And the balance is just purely providing our services as a design and operating entity and deploying our suite of brands to the various different properties around the country. So that's essentially very high level.
Yeah. And so what do you look for in a property and maybe even in a community for Pali Society, when you see something and you say, this could be a Pali Society hotel?
Yeah, I'm gonna also take a little circuitous route in answering that question. And the reason is that one of the things that I decided to do early on when I got into the hotel side of my career was to essentially focus on properties that had much less competition. And in the hotel business, that really means smaller hotels. And so if you look at the entirety of our portfolio, our average key count is probably something like 60 or 670 keys per property, which is on the small side for sure. And the reason that is that what I had learned in my, you know, just career overall was that the way that you limit your competition is go to places where others really don't. And so it was very purposeful. It was very much on purpose that we targeted properties that were smaller. And we assessed, in essence, the idea was to sort of institutionalize the inns, the local neighborhood inn business. And in my view, there's a desire for a local neighborhood inn in just about every market in the country and around the world. And so to answer your question is that first and foremost, we look for properties that fit within our range of hotel size. And meaning that once hotels get too large, we're not able to, I think, bring the same value that there's a lot of other people that provide value in larger scale hotels. And a lot of times you need to create momentum by attaching a large brand to it. So for us, first and foremost, we're looking properties where we can really do our thing, which is to curate smaller, quirkier properties in you know, various different markets. And so that's our number one criteria. And number two criteria is, you know, can we collaborate with partners and other constituents that really appreciate what we bring to the table, which is essentially a very proprietor-driven, design-driven enterprise that takes a somewhat counterintuitive approach to lodging properties. And so those are the two macro, very high-level things that we look for first. And then, of course, after that, you know, there has to be something unique about the location, and we can really do something special that fits into one of our brand profiles, and where we know we can be successful by deploying, you know, all of the resources and the things that we do that are unique. And so it's a sort of a very high level of how we're really looking at it.
Yeah. And what would you say is your typical, if you have a typical Pali Society guest?
You know, when we were a small regional operator, when we were in Los Angeles, I think we could, you know, we had three hotels in Los Angeles for a long time. And I think that at that time we were able to, I think, pinpoint the customer a little bit because it was regional and we appealed to a certain clientele, which was, you know, in those days was primarily, you know, entertainment, fashion, multimedia, people that just were really inspired by, you know, design and smaller assets, smaller properties that were very neighborhood centric. I would say now, because of the portfolio of brands and the portfolio of and the sort of the wide range of locations, I think that the customer has really widened and broadened a lot, because of course people now are also much more familiar with the brand than they were when we first started out. So I don't think we have a real demographic when it relates to age. But what I would say is that when people are making a hotel choice in any given market, our hotel appeals to people that want to stay in a place that feels connected to where they're staying, that has a, you know, sort of a design and a sensibility that is, you know, a slightly more bespoke, I would say, and a little bit more considered than some of the other sort of more mainstream brands. And so if someone's making a box to box comparison and they want to stay in something that they feel like they can get inspired, then we're their choice. And so I think I would say that would be today probably the best way to describe the customer.
You did leave out, in terms of your customer demographics, you know, lawyers who at one time were in their 30s looking to have a good night out and have a successful night at one of your restaurants or bars, which is how I frequented your Pali Hotel in West Hollywood next to the famous Barney's Beanery for many years. The atmosphere that you had created, I felt was really one of the, just I felt like you created a nightlife, a scene, an upscale scene that other hotel proprietors, you know, were trying to do, but you had the secret sauce. And it's so hard to have that, from the location to the people to you know, the food and beverage, and when you have it, it's like gold, and you don't know how long it's going to be in, especially in this city in LA. And so talk a little bit about, you know, the food and beverage and just the whole atmosphere and ambiance that you're trying to create. And maybe it's different from hotel to hotel, but for that particular hotel that we're talking about, it was spot on.
Well, thank you for that. You know, I would say that people really respond to authenticity when it relates to bringing locals into a hotel environment in particular, or into a food and beverage environment. And, you know, I think that I think that you have to create almost a 6 degrees of separation when it comes to spaces. And, you know, for now, for our entire portfolio can't be, you know, Blockbuster nightlife in every location, because it's not appropriate for every location. We have some hotels that are guest exclusive dining or whatever it might be. So I think you have to double down on each property, what's authentic to what it really wants to be. And not all of it always wants to be, you know, nightlife driven for young, on the, you know, on the rise, handsome lawyers like yourself. I think that, you know, sometimes you have to temper what your vision is depending on what you have there. That said, you know, I think that you also have to be mindful to not take yourself too seriously at all of these venues. And I think you want to create a sense of fun, and you want to create a sense of, you know, sort of escaping your sort of day to day on some basis. And if that's appropriate, then, you know, we will dig in with respect to that. That particular property that you were talking about just was sort of in the right place at the right time. And we were able to, I think, you know, create something that was a little bit unique. And so I think the DNA of that property definitely touches all of the other properties on some basis, and something that you learn, you know, it's an acquired you know, tool in your toolbox for creating places. So I think we sort of try and deploy that on some basis, but so I think it's slightly nuanced, but, you know, something we spend a lot of time and focus a lot of energy on.
So let's go back to your earlier years when you and I were talking at Soho Malibu. It really took me and had an emotional connection as to, you know, the various things that you were doing at the beginning part of your real estate career that had nothing to do with hotels.
Yeah.
So how did you get into the real estate business?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that most people don't know, because, you know, most of my profile revolves around the lodging part of the business and the brand part of the business, is that really I'm a real estate person. You know, that's how I started. I just sort of, by accident got in. My first job when I moved to Los Angeles was working for a real estate developer, not by some grand plan. It was just the only job that I sort of could get at the time. And I just sort of went with it. And so I worked for an you know, apartment house developer early on. And then I worked for a home builder for 10 years. And at an early age, I started my own company. And, you know, real estate is, you know, there's not a lot of, or at the time, at least, there wasn't a lot of young entrepreneurial people in the business. And so I was, you know, I just sort of latched on to being, to, you know, I brought a lot of sort of youthful energy, I think, to what it is that I was doing. And so the first part of my career was building a sort of a urban residential and mixed use development company, which was sort of the precursor to the lodging part of the business and creating the hotel company. But, you know, I have all the scars too, you know, and the, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs when you're in the real estate development business. But, you know, by the time, you know, sort of by 2005, it sort of built a pretty big company with a pretty big infrastructure and developing a lot of real estate, you know, in Southern California and in Northern California also. But, you know, one common theme in a lot of people that you've been speaking to on your podcast, which is so interesting, is that a lot of, you know, our collective careers were really shaped by the, you know, global financial crisis. And, you know, for me in particular, you know, it really shaped my thinking about what I wanted to do after that. And we can dig in as much as you want in terms of that process and going through that process. But it's really shifted my thinking in terms of what did I wanted to do post global financial crisis. And that really is what, you know, I was fortunate enough to, before the global financial crisis, to develop the hotel that you were talking about. And at the, you know, by 2009, that was the only thing that was left of this, you know, sort of giant portfolio that I had created. And it wasn't just me, you know, there was a lot of people going through the same process, but that's sort of de facto how I sort of ended up deciding that hotels were going to be my future, you know, 2009, 2010.
So pre-GFC, so, you know, let's look at a snapshot. In 2006,
yeah,
what was your portfolio?
So the portfolio was really sort of larger urban residential mixed-use development in Northern and Southern California with primarily institutional capital partners. Some of the smaller properties we were doing with friends and family capital, but it was really just sort of a very traditional capital stack, you know, where it was traditional construction financing and institutional capital, a lot of 95-5 type deals. And we were developing, you know, a lot of condominiums, for sale loft product. And, you know, it was mostly for sale housing. And we did some really big iconic properties. I don't tell people this very often, but, you know, by the time I stopped developing condos and mixed use properties, I think as a company or myself personally, when I had my own company, I did over 2 million square feet of development. So it was a lot. It was very robust for a really long time.
Yeah.
And that was pretty heady stuff for, you know, being a young guy. And having a big, you know, sort of a somewhat larger enterprise.
How did you make the connect? I mean, it's, you know, we've talked on this podcast a lot, the various ways to capitalize deals. You know, half of our client base, half of our guests probably capitalize it through the old fashioned syndication market, friends and family and others passing the hat around. And, you know, you have a dozen, two dozen investors, but the sponsor drives the bus and makes all the decisions. The other half has institutional contacts, institutional relationships, where they're the private equity or family office is providing 90-95% of the capital of the equity, like you were talking about, and they're really making the major decisions, or at least have consent rights. But it's harder to make those have those relationships. So, how were you able to crack into the institutional world in a market where, you know, on single family residential, you often don't see them?
Are you talking about pre-GFC?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that I did it was I just got really lucky. I worked for a development group. And at the time, I convinced them that this was primarily a second time move up home building company. And I convinced them that there was an opportunity to do more urban type residential development where you were doing sort of single family style properties at much higher densities than you would typically see in more suburban markets. And to make a very long story short, you know, they sort of let me run with it. And by the time that I had left that company after, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years, that particular part of the enterprise became really substantial. So before I started my own company, I already had created a lot of knowledge because I was running this division, and I created a lot of relationships, both on the debt side and on the equity side. Again, that was, you know, at the very highest level, you know, at that time in Southern California. And there was, at the time, it was a lot of CalPERS type on the equity side that was in residential at the time. And then there were a lot of lenders that were sort of, I would say, mid-cap, you know, banks that were lending on the debt side. And, you know, keep in mind that when I started my own company, or, you know, sort of at the end of my tenure with this group that I was working with, there was a lot of capital in the market.
Sure.
There was a lot of debt and equity that was available. And so when I started my own company, I was a known entity. Even though I was really young, I was a known entity. I had a track record of success. And so I was able to capitalize on those relationships to, you know, just create my own enterprise. And even though my balance sheet wasn't necessarily you know, as substantial as what an established developer would be. There was a room in the marketplace at the time for someone who was young and entrepreneurial, and you know, the deals that I was involved in were somewhat higher margins than what you would typically see because they were smaller and a little bit more quirky, and they just had more horsepower than a lot of the larger typical sort of for sale housing deals that you would see in suburban markets that were really, it was a much lower margin business. So that's how I cracked into it.
Yeah. And look, it's there are positives and negatives to when you take other people's money, whether it's the syndication route, mm-hmm. where you're dealing with, you know, like a herd of cattle, versus having one-stop shopping and you have an institution that's providing, you know, the vast majority of your equity, but you have a partner where you need to get their consent for almost all major decisions.
Oh yeah. Just a quick note on that. You know, the reality is that if you take institutional capital, you know, they really are, as you know, Andrew, very well know that, you know, they, even though they let you kind of do their thing if you're sort of following the business plan, but if the business plan goes astray, you know, they have the ability to pull a lot of strings to get you organized. And so, one thing that I would love to touch on at the right time is, you know, even though now we're a lodging company, a branded hotel management company, we really do understand that development process so succinctly, and we understand who pulls the levers, and we understand the capital stack, and we have a lot of savvy when it comes to the development process. And so one of the reasons that we've had, I think, such robust growth is because we're really good partners for developers that want to build hotels, because we're able to, I think, have a seat at the table about how to get from A to B in a very realistic way. A lot of people, especially with smaller properties, have unrealistic expectations about timeline, budget, and really what the debt and equity's expectations are. And so we can sort of, I think, bring, you know, we can accelerate knowledge, I think, by just bringing our own experience to the table with respect to what that is. But yeah, for sure, you know, you learn, you kind of learn, sometimes you learn the hard way about who really, you know, who really calls the shots when it comes to capital and everyone's vested interest in any given process.
Sure. I want to get into, you know, your outlook and the types of deals that you are planning on, that you're currently doing and planning on doing into 23. But you did say something about the GFC that I just want to touch upon. You said it just completely changed your outlook. I think as a person and as a real estate company. So what was it about the GFC that made you go all in on hospitality, especially during a time when, if you remember, I mean, Obama, who just became president, what was it, in 08, he was elected. So 09, he started his administration. I mean, it was literally a four-letter word if you had a company and you went to have, you know, junkets in Vegas and the curbing of business travel was pronounced in my industry and in big law. You know, pre-GFC, the amount of money that we spent traveling and entertaining, it was almost a blank check, and then it just you know, crumbled immediately and really had limited budget to do that sort of thing. So what was it about the GFC where you wanted to go into an asset class that was really hurting?
Yeah. So a couple things. One was, you know, until the GFC, I had known nothing but success. You know, I had known nothing but, you know, an upward trajectory, and for sure, some of it had to do with the energy and the vision that I brought to the table. But the reality is that most of it just had to do with, you know, being on in a real estate cycle that really was pointed up. And keep in mind, when I started my career, it was just getting through the, you know, the savings and loan issues that we had during that last downturn. So I sort of ran I was on the sort of the wave post savings and loan ROTC stuff all the way through to the GFC. So what happened for me was that I got a little bit lucky in that when things went sideways, I didn't really have a ton of exposure because I just got lucky in the cycle in that I was really sort of out of inventories of things I was trying to sell, or I was in a part of the development cycle that was sort of towards the end of a project, or maybe I'd already paid off a lot of the construction debt. And so I was really playing with, it was really more about eating into equity, which is never really fun. What happened to me personally, though, was that I just took it all so personally. And, it was so, even though I had a company and there were people around me, I just took it all on my own shoulders. And frankly, whether it's your lenders or your investors at that time, there was so much distress that, people looked to you for the reason that they were in a bad spot. And it was so uncomfortable to navigate friendships that were fading because of things outside of my control and or business relationships and other things that were happening, managing an economy and a real estate market on the down that's going down is so much harder than managing real estate on the way up. And I just, by the time I had gotten through it, a couple dynamics. One was really, I know this it sounds kind of funny, but I was, once everything, the dust settled, I was left with one hotel property. That was it. I'd liquidated all of the sale product. I had, given assets back to lenders. I had, traded assets for, getting out of, financial guarantees and all kinds of things. I tried to do it as elegantly as I could. And at the end, I ended up with this hotel that just happened to be doing very well, despite the fact that I didn't really know that much about the hotel business. I didn't do another deal until 2011. I just kind of licked my wounds and
brushed the dirt off
and tried to figure out what was next for me for 2008, 2009. And it wasn't until 2010 that I started to think about what would be next for me. I there's no way I was going to go get a job and work for somebody. But I also didn't want to go and try and resurrect a development career that I had to potentially go through the same process again. It was just too difficult. And I didn't want to take on that kind of exposure anymore. And I just sort of said, maybe this idea of building a brand that was more asset light, where I could offset some of the real estate risk onto, building a management style enterprise. Maybe that was a good fit for me. And so that's what I just did. I just dug in and did that. And the next couple deals that I did were really a function of me, to a certain extent, being in the right place at the right time. And because I want to say this the right way, because I was very cooperative with lenders and investors and people through a very turbulent crisis where a lot of people took the opposite route, where they were very combative. Because of that, the doors opened for me to be able to do other things in the future, where people knew that I was going to do the right thing, or at least that was my reputation. And so I was able to start doing new things and utilizing, the knowledge that I had and some relationships that I had, but I was really careful and I really didn't take on too much risk. And I decided that I was never going to take the developer risk myself again. And if I was going to be a sponsor in the deal, I was going to bring somebody else in to be to take on the developer role so I could focus my energy on the brands, the brand, you know, and the operating business more than, you know, actually taking on the developer exposure that that I had done previously.
Well, I was going to say, Avi, I mean, you know, hearing your story again now over the podcast and knowing it previously, I mean, it definitely is a truth that the way clients of mine and peers of mine handled themselves during the GFC really dictated how they were going to fare post GFC, and those that you know, handled it with grace and with candor and vulnerability and just being straightforward with their capital providers and lenders were the first ones that received the phone call from them. I mean, it's very similar to David Schwartzman. I don't know if you heard that podcast. It's a very similar story where now I'm sure Avi Brosh 2.0 post GFC, as we stand here at the end of 2022, beginning of 23, is in a much better position than you were in 2006 before the GFC.
Yeah, no question about it. And I wouldn't want to go through that experience again because it was really rough. But you know, when COVID came,
I was going to just ask, let's touch upon how. So I mean, you're in the hotel business, and your occupancy went to zero.
Yes. So I attribute everything that I did during COVID to. Not everything, but you know, a lot of what my reaction to COVID really, I really looked back on what I did right and what I did wrong, 2008, 2009, and 2010. And really, when COVID came, the number one thing that I did was just react very quickly. And you have to face the reality of what's going on, and you have to move very quickly. And so we were very quick to right size the company, very quick to right size the on the asset level, very quick to make very hard decisions, because making those hard decisions are very tough. And if you were, you know, if it was the, you know, sort of 10 or 15 years ago, I would have been much slower to make those decisions, because I would have thought that maybe it was just going to kind of figure itself out. So that was the big thing. That was number one, just to be real about what was going on and to, I think, on every level, be part of a solution as opposed to being part of the problem. A lot of people, when things go sideways, they're trying to figure out what's best for them and, you know, how to preserve their interests. And I think, again, like, you know, hearkening back to 2008, 2009, is to just sort of try and be empathic about what everything else that's going on and how other people are viewing the situation. So we were really fortunate. And so we had, you know, we had no debt at the corporate level, and we were able to, you know, make adjustments. And so the net result for us is that we were cash flow neutral during COVID, which, you know, to me, was a huge accomplishment to be able to keep everything intact. We had to, like I said, we had to make some very uncomfortable decisions, some of the hardest decisions ever made in terms of, you know, dealing with employees and you know, just sort of really trying to be thoughtful about kind of what was going on. But once we were able to stabilize in that way, then the opportunities started to present themselves. And if you have the headspace to not be focused on, you know, damage control, which we did very quickly, we were able to do things that perhaps others were not able to do during that time, because we didn't have that same pressure. As you know, Andrew, we bought some assets. We bought another hotel company during that time. And so we were able to, I think, fortify our position. So it allowed us to come out of COVID, like you said, stronger than we've ever been before.
Did you ever think, if you go back to March and April of 2020, when even into the summer of 2020, when you literally didn't have anyone, I would assume, staying at your hotels?
Yeah.
Unless if you were part of certain programs where you were able to house, you know, there was Project Room Key and there were other housing programs, but sitting where you were spring, summer of 2020, and then you fast forward, I don't know, 12 months, to 18 months, where I would assume for your hotels, no different than other hotels, where it was some of the most robust days, and probably still continues to be a very robust time for your industry. And so if you could talk about how, if you had to, you know, let some people go, downsize, downshift, because you weren't bringing in any revenue, and then all of a sudden, you know, the travel floodgates were opened. I mean, how are you able to then pivot and respond to that demand?
Great question. First thing I would say is to answer the first part of the question, which is no, there was just no way to predict, right? There was no way to predict the intensity of COVID in terms of its impact on everything. And then there was no way to predict the recovery and lodging right around the time of the vaccine, which is really what the turning point was. One of the things that was a very conscious decision at the beginning was I sort of subscribed to the idea that there weren't going to necessarily be major paradigm shifts to the hotel business. You know, I think a lot of people thought that there was going to be some sort of, you know, and rightly so, that the hotel business was going to have some radical change because of COVID. And I didn't sort of necessarily subscribe to that. And so as a result, part of our strategy early on was to keep the entirety of the management team intact. And whatever I needed to do that was really very important, because by then, by the time COVID hit, we had really built this great team. And so what being able to keep the team and taking the downtime to focus on fortifying a lot of our systems from, you know, whether it's technology or making sort of investments in areas that you a lot of times don't have the time to do because you're too busy. Once things started to pick up, we had the technology and the infrastructure from a people perspective, at least on the management side, to take advantage of ramping it back up. But, you know, that said, it was not easy. You know, it was not an easy thing to do. A lot of our employee base sort of exited the hospitality world, and we're still struggling to, you know, fully staff and, you know, fully create the kind of experience that we want from a staffing level perspective. But, you know, again, I just think that there was a little bit of luck, a little bit of experience, and, you know, just not having the least amount of external influence in terms of how you run your business as possible, was sort of how we were able to do it.
Yeah. And so as we sit here, you know, at the beginning of 2023, by the time this airs, you know, the Fed has certainly hit the brakes on our economy. Interest rates have increased a lot faster than anyone would have thought. The second half of 2022, at least in our business, was quite slow, especially in the institutional world, who seemingly like took the second half of the year off. You know, is there a recession? Is there not a recession? It's, you know, we'll let political folks debate that. But there's definitely a change in the economy. So how are you positioning Pally's Society going into the next 12 months and maybe even the next 2 to 3 years? You know, where do you want to see or what opportunities are you looking at and how you want to see the company be positioned over the next 2 to 3 years?
So for us, we're sort of in a somewhat enviable position in that the lion's share of our pipeline is baked, right? So our pipeline is financed, it's baked, it's either, you know, under construction or, you know, almost complete or whatever it might be. So for us, we're going to double the size of our company over the next 18 months because of the momentum from 21 and 22.
So you're saying 50 properties?
Let's put it this way. what I look at it more in terms of key count, right? So we're going to essentially double key count over the next 18 months. And so now beyond that, in terms of originations of kind of new things that are happening and those kinds of things, interestingly enough, our pipeline hasn't, in terms of our new things that are coming to us, hasn't really slowed down. Just the nature of the deals themselves has changed. And what I mean by that is, and this is going to come to no surprise, but the projects that we're working on now are projects now that have a slightly longer time horizon than they typically would. A lot of times we would get involved in things that were sort of go. And a lot of the things that are coming into us now are things that are, you know, slated for a little bit further on down the line when we, I think just generally there's a general perspective that the capital markets will, you know, adjust, or the things that are coming that people want us to do that are more in the short term are projects that are financed with a significant amount, if not entirely, in pure equity and cash. And because our deals are sort of bite-sized pieces of risk, because they're a little bit smaller, people are willing to underwrite those capital stacks, you know, with their own resources, or maybe they're even doing balance sheet financings or other kinds of non-traditional debt pieces in order to get those things financed. So in a nutshell, you know, I can't speak for everybody, but, you know, 23 is going to be a very robust growth year for us. And in terms of on the origination side, I'm really looking, we're sort of seeing things that are going to come to market more 25, 26. And then the shorter term things are really being done with cash or very low leverage. And that's sort of what I see from a market perspective. You know, I think that we had sort of this post-vaccine artificial pent-up demand in the lodging space. I just think that the lodging space is going to kind of return to sort of more normal, where the better properties are going to do better, the better markets are going to do better, and we're just going to get back to slightly something that's a little bit more predictable, and the better operators are going to do better, and they're the ones that are going to shine. And so I just sort of think that that's kind of where we're headed. The lodging market continues to be, you know, relatively strong compared to other asset classes. And I don't have any reason to think that that would not continue. Obviously, any sort of, you know, this inflationary period and this sort of, you know, forced slowdown by the Fed, which I think makes sense on some basis, you know, is going to have a net effect on all asset classes. I would say the biggest thing that I'm looking at is really people going back to the office in a more robust way. We're not seeing it every market. Like San Francisco, for example, we're just not seeing people going back to the market.
Does that affect your business, whether people are physically in an office, going to an office or not?
It depends on the market for us. So San Francisco, for example, I use San Francisco as an example, is a heavy downtown office, you know, convention driven market. So in that,
sure.
In that way, yes. But like our hotel in Santa Barbara, no, right? That's almost fair enough. You know, so it just depends on where we are and the market. But, you know, I'd like to see it more. We don't, because our hotels are small, we don't do a lot of corporate travel. It's a very specialty type of corporate travel that we do. But it's obviously, it is impactful, and it is really beneficial. And, you know, for our restaurants, we want people walking around and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, getting people back to the office, you know, in offices, I think is very important in a lot of these markets. And if I were to touch on one thing, you know, I would say is, you know, a lot of these cities that we're in, and just a lot of cities I'm sure that you some of your clients are in, is these cities need to generate the political will to deal with you know, some of the houseless issues and some of the crime issues. They need to get their arms around it in order for, I think, there to create a better market for everybody and just a better experience for everybody in a lot of these major markets that are really struggling in those areas, like, you know, in ways that I never could have anticipated.
But yeah, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on.
You absolutely could.
Homeless. And I recently went to a great YPO conference, and the new mayor, Karen Bass, was there. And I mean, what we've seen living both of us in LA is astonishing. And you know, how does we do want to end this podcast shortly here, but just sort of one final question on that, since you brought it up. You know, how does LA compare to other cities in which you have hotels? I mean, you are an urban centric mm-hmm. hotel. You do have hotels, like you said, in Santa Barbara and more vacation spots. But in terms of the urban areas of yeah. LA, San Francisco, Miami, Portland, Seattle, yeah. you know, what are you seeing?
What I'm seeing is a lot of these cities, and I'll end on, you know, and I would consider Los Angeles one of them, is that a lot of these cities don't have the political will right now and the political strategy to deal with this houseless population and crime. And, you know, I see a lot of statistics about, well, you know, this crime is up, but this crime is down. And that's, to me, it's just semantics. People in these cities don't feel safe. And there is a, you know, if people perceive it as not safe, then it's not safe. And you know, there's just rampant, blatant crime that you're seeing happening outside your front door. A lot of these cities are really dirty, and it just doesn't make sense. You know, these are cities that have a tremendous amount of resources, and until they can figure out a way to clean their streets and clean their, you know, keep things looking good. I think back of when I first moved to Los Angeles, which was in 1988. I couldn't believe how clean and beautiful and unbelievably fantastic it was. And we've just had a real precipitous drop. So yeah. I am rooting for Karen Bass to come up with some strategies that people can get on board with. But all these cities are in the same predicament, Andrew. I see it in Portland. I see it in San Francisco. I see it in Seattle. You know, I even see it in some of our smaller markets that we're in, where, you know, these cities are just struggling with a strategy to deal with these problems. But I continue to be optimistic about, you know, finding solutions, which is you got to put these people in shelter. That's thoughtfully done. And I don't know if it's more funding the police, less funding the police, community-based police. I'm not an expert in any of those things, but I do know that there needs to be something different than being done now in order to get these cities, you know, in a place where they can thrive.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I like to end my podcast on a few lightning round questions. So quick answers to the following questions, and I'll let you go and enjoy the end of the holiday season. So Avi, if you were going to do anything else besides being real estate, what would it be?
Maybe an architect.
All right. Well, that's still real estate, but fair enough. A different aspect within the real estate business. Specific to your industry, average daily rents, your rates, average daily rates, overall, not necessarily to you on the Poly Society. Do you think over the next 12 months, will the daily hotel rates go up, down, or be flat?
I think that the whole dollar rates will go up, but I think based on, you know, if you look at it from an inflationary basis, I would say it's flat.
Would you say you have more competition from other similarly positioned hotels or Airbnb? Or both?
I would say Airbnb.
Interesting. We'll see what happens to Airbnb over the next 5 to 10 years. Is there a market that you don't have a hotel currently in that you would love to be in the next few years?
I'd love to be in a ski market.
Ah, I like that. Pali.
You know, like a Pali house, one of our suited products, and one of the either a ski market or maybe a you know, some other sort of resort market. I think we would do really well in one of those.
Fantastic. Well, I can't thank you enough, Avi, for your time, your generosity, your friendship.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and sharing this show with others.